Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to 10% Happier early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
Hey guys, I'm literally phoning in my introduction to this week's podcast because I can't make it to the studio because I'm in Acapulco, not on vacation, doing a story for Nightline, which will air, I think, in the next few weeks. Actually, quite an incredible story. Anyway, that's not what you came here for. We've got a great guest this week who has some really fascinating theories about the overlap between attachment theory, which is a psychological idea, and meditation. George Haas is his name. Before we get to him, I just want to do a few items of business. I can't take calls this week because I'm not in the studio, but I do want to mention one thing. This is kind of like a PSA for a previous guest. If you haven't heard her before, I recommend you go back and listen to her episode, Jessica Morey. She goes by Jess, so Jess Morey. She runs a program called IBME, sometimes known as Inward Bound Mindfulness Education. Outward Bound is the program where teens go into the woods. Inward Bound is where teens also go into the woods, but also meditate. It's from everything I've heard, a great program. And she just wanted me to remind people that if any parents or teenagers are listening to this, you can go to ibme.info, ibme.info, and there's room for this summer's retreats. A lot of parents come to me and talk to me about the anxiety their teenagers are dealing with, and we know it's on the rise. And so this is one thing I think is worth looking into. Okay. So our guest this week, as I mentioned, George Haas is his name. He's a meditation teacher. He lives in L.A. He focuses a lot on attachment theory, which is about the critical role that caregivers play in any person's development. George comes to this from a position of pain, really, in his personal life. He had a really rough childhood. He went on to experiment with a lot of different kinds of meditation, which he credits with helping get him sober. So he says it in a much more interesting way than I do. So I'll shut up and bring you George Haas.
From ABC, this is the 10% Happier Podcast. I'm Dan Harris. Thanks for doing this, even though you have a cold. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Happy to be here.
Let me ask you the question I ask everybody, which is how did you get into the meditation game?
I guess I would say that I was desperate and in pain and wanted something that would help. And I found that doing even a basic concentration practice relieved that immediately. And so I had an advantage or I saw an advantage in being able to practice.
The aforementioned desperation and pain, what was that about?
I like to say that I had a crappy childhood and that a lot of the legacies of that came with me. And so that as I went on to try and get things to happen for me, say in my teens and 20s, that differentiation period, there were a lot of obstacles to getting that to happen, mostly relational. I had a lot of opportunities, but because I couldn't manage the relationships, the opportunities didn't really grow into much.
So when you say crappy childhood, can you tell me a little bit about that? To the extent that you're comfortable, you don't have to share anything you don't want to.
Yeah, I'm Irish family, a lot of drinking, a lot of violence, a lot of various kinds of abuse.
So sounds genuinely crappy.
Yeah, no, it's crappy.
By anybody's definition.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I've read about you that you're interested in attachment theory, and I'm hearing that come through in everything you said up until the last thing you said, which is that you had opportunities, but the relationships couldn't blossom because you had stuff on your own end that you needed to deal with.
Right. I was very dissociative coming out of my childhood, and dissociation in intimate relationships doesn't work very well because you're not really there a lot of the time. And I had probably the most extreme outcome of attachment disturbance that you have. I've had my AAI done. Do you know an AAI?
No.
An adult attachment interview is an assessment tool for what your actual attachment strategy is. And so mine my outcome from childhood was one of the most disturbed.
Really? So you were about to say something. I apologize for interrupting you. Before you go down that whatever road you were about to go down, there may be some people aren't really familiar with attachment theory. Can you just walk us through what that is and then get to wherever you were going?
Sure. Attachment theory was originated by John Bowlby and Mary Ainsworth. It was John Bowlby's theory. He was an English psychiatrist one of the things I should tell you is that I can go into incredible detail about these things, so I'm not sure what's appropriate. But
this is a podcast, man. You can do whatever you want. Right. No rules.
How familiar are you with your psychoanalytic history?
Assume zero, because it's close to the truth.
Okay. Freud and Jung were the big guys at the end of the beginning of the 1900s, and then they moved into a kind of secondary Anna Freud, and Melanie Klein was an object relations theorist. All of these were, in a general sense, about how you react to things, not what happens to you. And John Bowlby's interest really was in, isn't it what happens to you that affects these outcomes? And if you could track that, then you might be able to understand what kind of behavior, what kind of conditions a child faces and how that affects them, and whether they would come into a skill set as an adult that was based on actually what happened to them, not on how they, in imagination or fantasy, related to it. What he discovered with Mary Ainsworth is three main kinds of attachment. So people who are securely attached.
To their mothers.
It doesn't have to be their mothers, but it often is. Their primary caregiver. Really what it is the relationship between the mother or the primary caregiver and the infant that forms an idea of your own competency to get your needs met, and also what you can expect from the world. So there you are, a child, 3 months old, you cry out for someone to take care of you, and depending on how they show up, you develop a working model of yourself as capable or incapable of getting your needs met. Mm. And you also develop a working model of what you can expect from the world. So if they show up good enough, you have a sense that I'm confident I can get my needs met, and the world is likely to meet my needs. And if they don't do that, then you develop other views. I'm not confident of getting my needs met, and the world is likely not to meet them. Or I'm not competent to get my needs met, but the world will conditionally respond to me depending on how I perform. Or the world, I'm not competent of getting my needs met, and the world is a dangerous place that I should not engage in because of what can happen.
And so were you in that last category there?
Yeah.
Yeah, so you grew up, was it New York City in which you grew up?
No, I grew up in Chicago.
Okay, so Chicago, difficult family as a consequence of insufficient or not good enough attachment. You end up viewing the world as a hostile place, where you can't get your needs met.
Right. I grew up in an affluent way, but also with a depressed mother who a lot of drinking in my family. Those things are very scary for children because they alter the nature of how your caregiver responds to you depending on how much they've had to drink, which you don't really know how to calculate as a child. My mother also tended to be violent and unpredictably violent, and so those things were also scary and hard to manage. We all have the conditioning that we had as children, and one of the things that it does is it affects these two things, the working model of self and the working model of the world. If you don't know that you have a working model of the self that says that you're not capable of getting your needs met, you still go about the world as if that's true for you. And if you have the view that the world won't help you, you still go about the world as if that's true. Now, people who have a secure attachment, they may not be aware either that they think of themselves as capable of getting their needs met and that the world will meet their needs, but they do go about exploring the world in that way. In one sense, what we're describing is in view, so in a conventional meditation way, exploring the view of the self and the world. If you don't think the opportunity is there for you, you often don't even see that it's there, even if it's being offered to you.
When you refer to opportunities, what do you mean?
Well, somebody likes you or you have a work opportunity. I mostly think of life as this pursuit of love and of work, or work is a term of meaning, maybe a better term. You want to pursue and engage in activity which actually has meaning to you, and you want to do it in a community of people who love you and will support you. And if you can do that, it doesn't really matter what it is you're doing, as long as you found meaning in what you do, and also that the people are there to share that exploration with you. In attachment, we would call that attachment in the relationships and exploration. And then, depending on the conditioning you had, either you're good at relationships and good at exploring, or some combination of that. For an example, as a dismissing adult, this would be sort of in the narcissistic end of, we're a very psychologically oriented society in that way, so we often use the Masterson model of narcissism at one end and borderline at the other. Different in attachment, it's the dismissing view, is that I don't really need anybody. And the internal sense is I'm great, I'm fantastic, I should have whatever I want. And with other people, the view is, you know, they're not really up to my level of fantasticness, so I'm entitled to just take from them whatever I want. And so you see in those kinds of relationships, it's one directional. You give to me, and I don't reciprocate. In a preoccupied adult, which would be an anxious, ambivalent child, the caregiving was so erratic that the child could never rely on the caregiver. This is different, say, from the dismissing adult whose childhood was one of constant neglect. Nobody ever came, and so they didn't actually ever develop the capacity to rely on anybody. And they explore, but they never come back and share their exploration with anybody because nobody was interested. And so they tend to explore things that have social standing, social meaning, rather than things that may be authentically meaningful to them.
How does meditation help with attachment issues?
Well, first you need to be able to see what it is that's happening, and then you need to be able to move in a direction that's more secure. Most of this is going to be in seeing the mind states, what you do, what you think, how that affects how you view things. And then also there's a big piece around emotional regulation. The attachment mechanism regulates the fear of abandonment or fear of being harmed physically. And so it's an activating strategy which makes you seek proximity to somebody who will protect you. Mm. So it can either, it turns on and it turns off. In a secure person, it turns on and then you get proximity and then it turns off. So that's a pretty functional thing. In a dismissing person, it just turns off. So whenever they feel a need for somebody else, they turn off their attachment mechanism. So they're not seeking proximity. They're not seeking closeness. In a preoccupied adult, for instance, it hyperactivates. So they're constantly seeking proximity, constantly seeking closeness.
And where were you? Were you dismissive, preoccupied?
I was, it's called unresolved, cannot classify, extremely preoccupied and extremely dismissing at the same time.
Like off the charts.
Well, yeah, just sort of at that end of the needle's all the way over.
Yeah.
Right.
How did that manifest itself?
I was highly dissociative. So, you know, dissociation.
Yeah, you're just not there. You're off in greener pastures in your own mind.
Zooming in and out of the present moment. The colloquial term for cannot classify as fearful avoidant. So I was the sweetest guy around, but I was completely unreliable. Fearful avoidant people need to withdraw to emotionally regulate. And so they withdraw if something happens. If there's a conflict in the relationship, they will withdraw from the relationship and stay withdrawn until they've figured out the perfect thing to do to come back into the relationship, because they're afraid that if they make a mistake, you'll kill them. And I'm not really kidding about that. The fear is at that level. But you can imagine a child with a depressed, violent mother who, if they make the wrong move, she goes off into a rage, which is completely terrifying. And so you're hyper sensitive to what you have to do, and you have to do it right, or anything could happen. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. As you carry that into your adult life, of course, the likelihood that that's going to happen is very small, but it still feels like that. That's still what the view is. And so you engage in figuring out the perfect response. And if it takes you 3 months to figure out the perfect response, you've been gone for 3 months, and then you just show up and present the solution that you've come up with. The main harm to relationships is not that you have come up with the right thing or the wrong thing. It's that you're not reliable in showing up for people. And so it's the lack of reliability, really, that damages the relationships. People are happy to have you around, but they don't count on you. And you can't be in intimate, supportive relationships if people won't rely on you. It's a kind of mutual exchange. If you look at what a mutual relationship is based on, really, it's the ground floor of it is reliability, that you can really count on somebody to show up for you when you need them. Then all you have to do is trade them that you'll show up for them reliably when they need it. That's the mutuality piece. And that creates a felt sense of safety in relationship. If you have that felt sense of safety in relationships, you'll be willing to attune to them. So attunement is this process of connecting empathetically. And also, you'll be able to reveal yourself authentically to them. If you don't trust somebody else, you tend to withhold an authentic expression of yourself. If you're not willing to let somebody see you, then nobody sees you, and you feel unseen, which is not a great place to be. If you attune to somebody, and then the empathetic connection deepens, they can actually soothe you or co-regulate you emotionally. And then what comes from that basis is a felt sense of delight in seeing the other person. This is a model that was developed by Dan Brown up at Harvard. Do you know what it's like to have somebody see you and just be delighted that you're there, that you're who you are without needing to do anything?
I had really good parents.
I'm glad.
Yeah.
So you know what that is.
I do, yeah.
But then imagine a child who never had that.
I can. It's wrenching.
Yeah.
So I kind of derailed you. I had asked you a question about how meditation is helpful for people with attachment disorders, and you were starting to answer it, and then I asked you another question about how it showed up for you. So I apologize for that. Back to that, you said the first thing, the way in which meditation is helpful, and this sounds completely intuitive and true to me, is just to be able to see clearly what's going on.
Right.
But once you see things clearly, how is meditation useful?
Well, you want to be, in seeing things clearly, move your attention into a more secure framework of operating in relationships. A great deal of that is going to be emotional regulation. I think that the goal of meditation in the long game is going to be classical enlightenment. But there's a lot of things that you have to do along the way so that you're capable of going into that
classical
territory.
Enlightenment, what does that mean?
Well, in a Theravada sense, it's...
Theravada being old school Buddhism.
Yeah, old school Buddhism. I'm a Theravada teacher, so that's what I do. That you see through the nature of self that it's ephemeral and not substantial, that you see that everything arises and passes, that nothing lasts, that as a human being, we're stuck in a body which will grow old, get sick, and die, that we have to deal with getting things we want and losing them, that we have to deal with not getting what we want. We have to deal with putting up what we don't want, putting up with what we don't want. And then also that subtle, ongoing, constant irritation that nothing is exactly the way that we would have it if we were actually in charge of anything, which is kind of a double-edged sword. It's not what we want, and we're not really in charge of anything. If you could see into that, it would change this perspective that you have, and you would move from an identification with the consciousness of experience into awareness. And then you would, this figure ground reversal would put you into awareness where there's no suffering in that sense.
So it's, you're not so stuck in the ups and downs and contents of your concerns, and you're actually just the person, the one who is aware of all of this coming and going. Yes. On the stage of your own consciousness.
Yeah, that's it.
So that would be classical enlightenment. So you're saying that's the long con.
That's the long game.
Yeah.
The short game then is, how do you get your life up to organized in such a way that it can support you in getting to that? And often what we find is it's relational and also work-wise or exploration-wise. Many of us spend most of our life engaged in activities that don't really have meaning to us. And depending on where that's a problem, not knowing what is meaningful, for instance, is one, and not being able to organize your life around spending most of the time and energy that you have engaged in an activity that's meaningful is a problem for a lot of people. And so you begin to examine how are you organizing your life and living your life, and then moving in the direction of that. A lot of that comes from the practice of meditation and being able to see these fluctuations of self come and go, and fluctuations of desire come and go, or aversion come and go. And then what we notice is that in order to change a lot of these things, because there are strategies that we use to emotionally regulate ourselves, we need to provide an alternative emotional regulation strategy, because the body mind will emotionally regulate itself with the strategies that you have. You don't have agency over that. What you have agency over is the strategies that the body mind uses, and you have to learn them. It's like anything else. In the beginning, it's effortful, it's conscious, it's this repetition of practice. But once they become automatic, then the body-mind just does them. And meditation, which is this practice of repetition and paying attention and training the mind, allows you to develop these alternative skills that then take over for the ones that aren't as useful.
So all these strategies that you use, like when you have a fight with somebody, you retreat to your corner and don't come back until you're confident that they won't kill you. All the stuff that you described that you were doing because of the difficult relationship you had with your mother. One first step is see it clearly, and second step is to be able to develop healthier strategies.
Right. So if we use that as an example, what I suggest that people do is they pay attention to the normal window of communication, which will be different with each person.
Normal window of communication?
Well, some, you know, you communicate to somebody and they can communicate right away back, but it's too soon. Or they can communicate back too late. So another way to put that is, when you communicate to somebody that you're relying on in a relationship, how long is too long before you begin to worry that something's wrong? And how short is too short that you're irritated that you have to attend to it again? That would be the window. Between those two points would be the window of communication. That if you drop a communication in there, the other person just accepts it and receives it. In the fearful avoidant problem is that you don't respond in the window of communication, and so the fix is to respond. It doesn't matter what you do as long as you respond, because that's the thing that makes you reliable. You can always fix bad communication. You can't fix an unreliableness in the relationship. Secure people have a view of the world as people who will meet their needs, and they have a view of themselves as capable. They don't do unreliable because it doesn't even occur to them to consider it. So secure people are most often relationships with other secure people, because that's the dynamic. dismissing people don't do mutual. And so they're most often in relationships with preoccupied people who are willing to abandon their exploration for proximity. And as long as they can be close to the dismissing person who never likes to be alone, they're fine, but they don't get to explore because it's all about the dismissing person. And the fearful avoidant person is almost never in relationship with a secure person because they're so unreliable. The dismissing person doesn't care whether they come and go as long as when they show up, they have juice.
Right. Yeah.
And they're never in relationships or not in long relationships with the preoccupied people because they need to withdraw for emotional regulation. And the preoccupied person needs proximity for emotional regulation. So you can begin to describe these views and people can begin to identify them and see how they function. And then in order, for instance, for a fearful avoidant person to show up in the window of opportunity, they have to be able to regulate the fear mind that is keeping them from doing it. And so you apply a meditation technique to the fear experience well enough that you can make the action or the gesture to communicate. And then you've, in that sense, resolved that difficulty in the relationship.
This show is brought to you by BetterHelp. I got to tell you, I feel so much better when I talk about my anxiety instead of keeping it bottled up. There's an expression that I first heard from the great researcher and also Zen practitioner Robert Waldinger, never worry alone. Our temptation many times is to keep it bottled up, but the data really show that the people who do the best in life, who live the longest and are the happiest, have strong relationships with people with whom they can talk about whatever's going on in their lives. And for me, therapy is part of that. If you're thinking of starting therapy, you might give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/happier today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/happier. As they say at Amica, empathy is our best policy. Whether you need auto, home, or life insurance, they're ready to help you protect the things that matter most to you. They're a mutual company, customer-owned, in service to you. Amica representatives are here when you need them, and you can take comfort knowing a real person will be there on the phone to take care of you, because the greatest measure of their success is your satisfaction. So let me loop back to the very first question I asked you that sent us on this very interesting down this very interesting path. The first question I asked was how and why did you start meditating? And you said it was pain and distress. How old were you? What was going on in your life? And then what happened subsequently?
My adolescence was in the 60s. Mm-hmm. And so the first big understanding of meditation was transcendental meditation.
Yes.
And the White Album, you know, the Beatles.
I love that album. Dear Prudence, one of my favorite songs. Maybe my favorite song of all time. Play it to my son all the time.
So I was deeply resentful of the $400 that they wanted for the mantra. And so I grew up in Evanston, Illinois. I went to Northwestern and I talked somebody into giving me their mantra, and so I practiced with that for a while. It was a good concentration meditation, worked pretty good. And then I was a vagabond hitching around Europe for a year or so, and I came across Ram Dass. Be Here Now was a book that he wrote.
Ram Dass, just for the uninitiated, born Richard Alpert.
Yes.
Boston, Massachusetts, in that area. Jewish guy, went to Harvard or went to fancy schools, and then got in trouble as a professor at Harvard where he gave acid to the students as part of some sort of test or something.
He was Timothy Leary yeah. crowd, yeah.
Yeah, so anyway, and then went to India, became Baba Ram Dass,
right.
And the rest is history.
Yeah, so that actually worked really well for me. And then I was in New York in the 80s during the AIDS period.
Where you were an artist.
I was, yeah. Very hard period, that you know, every couple of months going to a funeral of somebody who had been a dear friend, and a whole generation blighted, really. And then the terrible response from the Reagan administration. So I then started to practice more seriously. It'd been kind of dilettante up until then. Also, got sober. So I was a hard drinker, just in line with my family system of emotional regulation.
Right. You came by it honestly.
Yeah, indeed. So taking away the use of drugs and alcohol as a primary means of emotional regulation, I needed to develop some alternative to that. And meditation seemed to be really excellent at that. Turns out it really is excellent as an emotional regulation strategy. So if you have afflictive strategies and you want to stop using them, you can't just stop using them. You have to stop and replace. And meditation was great for that. I was mostly doing Trungpa Rinpoche, so that would be in the Tibetan school.
So this, you went from TM to Baba Ram Dass to Trungpa Rinpoche, who was a Tibetan teacher who moved to the West and started teaching people.
What can I tell you? I'm a seeker.
No judgment here, man. Just trying to make sure I got the chronology straight.
So then when I moved to L.A. in 92, I did some Vipassana introductory classes. I really liked Vipassana. It was a great thing. And I was a Dharma orphan for years because my relational problems made it impossible to have a relationship with a meditation teacher, too, until I found Shinzen Young, who has been my teacher for 20 years.
Previous guest on this podcast. Awesome guest. Everybody should go back and listen to that one. That guy is awesome. Yeah. And actually, one of Shinzen's other students, guy named Jeff Warren, who's based out of Toronto. He and I just wrote a book together. So I'm quite familiar with Shinzen, big fan.
Yeah, awesome. So one of the things about having a crappy childhood is that I have a kindness bar, which is really high. I mean, in order for me to be willing to be in a close relationship with you, you have to be somebody of extraordinary kindness. And that was the problem with most of the meditation teachers I encountered. They weren't kind enough for me. But Shinzen was, and that opened up a whole kind of process of really being able to go into these mind states and the conditioning, then to see it clearly, and then in seeing it clearly, recognize what I needed to do in order to shift it into a more secure way of being in the world. And then also, he's an enlightenment teacher. So the first time I sat with him, he said, "I expect all of you to become enlightened in this lifetime," which I really was encouraging, found encouraging, because the first class I went to, there was a moment where we all went around and said, "Why did you come here?" And I said, "I came here because I wanted to be enlightened," and everyone laughed, but it wasn't a good laugh, you know.
It was like an uncomfortable laugh, yeah. But you weren't kidding.
No, I wasn't kidding at all.
So has he gotten you there?
I think that my practice actually has transformed my life entirely.
My practice has transformed my life, I don't know about entirely, but I wouldn't call myself enlightened.
Okay. You know, it's a kind of dicey thing, that line of conversation.
Yes, that's why I'm doing it.
I would.
Explain why it's dicey.
Because we're a competitive culture, and different traditions regard the conversation of your attainments differently. For instance, in a Tibetan practice, nobody, even the most enlightened people, will tell you what attainments they've made, because it's considered so rude.
Meditative attainments, yes. Yeah, in fact, Tibetans will often say, "Oh, I'm no, I'm a terrible meditator,"
yeah,
even
totally.
Though, like, in those in the know, you know, they're super enlightened.
Right. Culturally in the West, and maybe this is just a good thing to know, what is enlightenment? What do you think enlightenment is? If you told me what you thought enlightenment was, I could tell you whether that was what I have. But if I say to you, "Yes, I'm enlightened," without defining that very specifically, who knows what we're actually talking about?
Well, classically in Buddhism, it's the uprooting of greed, hatred, and desire.
I would say that no, I haven't completely uprooted any of those. But if you look at the four-path model of Theravada Buddhism, that's arahatship, which yes. is this fully enlightened.
Can I just jump in for a second just to explain that? Because okay. So the four-path model of enlightenment, just for those who haven't studied this thing, is basically, and I'm going to put it in simply, there are four stages on the way to what's known as full enlightenment
right.
or arhatship.
Right.
And each step along the way, you gradually erode the hold with which greed, hatred, and delusion has over you. You gradually erode the hold that these defilements have over you.
Right.
So anyway, back to you.
I would think not arhat.
My teacher is a guy named Joseph Goldstein. I'm sure you've heard that name. And a great, amazing teacher. He often says somewhere between the first and the fourth, you know.
That would work for me.
Yes, because – the reason for your reticence is I want to affirm there's a good reason for this. When I first started asking people about enlightenment and they would get really cagey, I thought – what is this? Like some weird mafia omerta thing? I didn't get it. It's what you said earlier. We live in a competitive culture, and if you start saying too much about where you are in this model, which, by the way, is just one model of enlightenment, then people start measuring where they are against you, and it gets into a whole weird competitive thing. So better in some ways to be a little bit cagey.
Right. What I think that it's important for you to do is to understand what it is and then look at the person and see if they actually manifest that. That would be the better way to do it because, you know, you can say anything.
Yeah.
Actually – so from a personal point of view, learn what it is that enlightenment is and then see if you recognize those characteristics in the person that you're going to work with so that you know where they're actually at.
I think it's very well said. That you just brought it down to the most useful level
right.
possible. So you've had such an interesting life, a lot of which we won't be able to get to. You're an artist. In fact, the reason why you're in New York right now is because you've had this your opening at MoMA.
Club 57 show at MoMA.
And you mentioned before that you were a doorman a lot of the big, I think this is probably pre-sobriety, a doorman a lot of the big clubs here in New York.
Well, actually, it was my sobriety job.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That seems like, in terms of people, places, and things, maybe not the best decision.
Doormen are outside.
Yeah,
where
right.
Where there's no drinking.
Yeah, but you're getting the waft,
and you're constantly witnessing the horror of it.
Oh, fair
so
enough.
It's very reinforcing.
Okay. Gotcha. But well, I said all that to get me to the question I wanted to ask, which is, what do you do now?
I'm a full-time meditation teacher, and I still make art, so that's what I do. I live in Los Angeles. We have a group called Metta Group, and we're calling it a meditation and psychotherapy center. We are focusing heavily on attachment. For instance, attachment disturbance is the basis of addiction. And so we have a model for addiction. Attachment disturbance is the basis of personality disorders. So we're going to be working with people with personality disorder. And we do a kind of psychoeducation about what attachment is and what meditation is and how they can work together. And then we train people to do meditation techniques that will be supportive in transforming their insecure attachment more towards secure attachment. And so that's basically what I do.
What about people who had great parents and healthy attachment and are still jerks? How do you explain that?
Because attachment isn't the whole game.
Okay. I was referring to myself.
You'd have to convince me of that.
No, I'm talking the old version.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. I still retain the capacity to be a jerk, but it was the old version.
Yes, I think that we all should have that as a way of being in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Spontaneity, freedom. You have the early attachment experience, really, which winds up at about 3 years old by the time, Actually, I was at talking to Dan Brown, and he said that they have a new study that shows that the first installation of the working model of self happens between 2 and 5 months. But by the time you're 3 years old, it's pretty well fixed, and it can stay that way the whole of your life if you don't do something to change it or some adverse circumstance doesn't affect it. What happens next is we begin as soon as your parents turn you loose into, say, preschool or school, you begin the operation of negotiating your own personal relationships, and depending on how that history goes, that also affects greatly the experience of somebody. If you like somebody and they like you back, and that consistently happens, it creates a different kind of person than if you like somebody and they don't like you and that happens, or it's a mix that sometimes you can get somebody and sometimes you can't. A lot of that is cultural and the way that you look and your socioeconomic stuff that you don't have any choice about, really. And then in puberty, there's another one of these cycles that happen when we add that exploration around sex. Are you, what's your sexual orientation? What's your gender? Are you able to attract and be in relationship with the people that are attractive to you, or are you not? And that also can have a great impact. If you're consistently going for people that you can't have, it creates a sense of deprivation. If you easily find the people that you want and you're able to have relationships with them, those are the main three things that affect that attachment cycle.
Can you have too healthy an attachment? Like, I have a kid at home who's about to turn 3. He's our only son. And, he does not have any problem getting his needs met. Because
right.
Whenever he asks for something, like, there's a swarm of people, you know, trying
Which
to help him.
Which is totally awesome.
Right? Yeah, right. But couldn't that go pear-shaped in some way?
Well, I think the term in contemporary society is a helicopter parent.
Yes. We try not to do that, but yeah. He gets his needs met.
So you want to develop in the kid the idea that if he has a need and he expresses it, that somebody will help him get the need met. That creates a great sense of security. You want to encourage them to explore what's meaningful to them, and you want to be delighted by the experience of them exploring. So it's these two things. They can go off and explore at the edge of their capacity to explore, and they know 100% that you're there when they come back from that.
That's called, I believe, I've read a lot of books by my friend Dr. Mark Epstein, calls it ego coverage, I think is the term. Something like they can go off in exploring knowing that you're there kind of watching.
Right, yeah. If you don't think anybody will be there, when you get back, you go off and explore, but you don't come back.
Yeah.
If you're worried whether they'll be there, you don't go explore. What you want to try and do is teach your child to find meaning in the activities that they pursue, and that the meaning should be their own.
It's interesting you use the term delight, because as a parent, that is, I would say, the primary emotion that I feel, just, you know, I can just gazing at him.
Right. That's awesome.
Yeah, it's awesome for me. I don't know if he likes it, but I think he thinks I'm annoying.
Which is totally fine as long as it doesn't affect the delight that you're giving him, right?
No. Yeah, no, sometimes it's bad for my ego, but whatever.
Well, yes. Some kids don't have that. They have conditional delight.
Yeah, I know.
So, for instance, somebody who grows up to be a dismissing person, it's very likely that the only delight that they could get was when they delighted in their parent or they idealized their parent. Mm. So they know that they're getting bad care, and the only way they can get any response at all from their caregivers is by presenting an ideal view of the care that they're getting. So you can imagine the schism that that creates in them. People who grow up to be preoccupied adults have had no experience at any time of delight. They're never delighted in, because the way that they get connection is by bringing up problems. So they scan for what's difficult and then they bring it up to you in a sort of angry way so that you'll fix it. But it has a tendency to short circuit the delight that they would experience from someone else. And fearful avoidant adults are too afraid to be seen, so they never present themselves openly, and so nobody can see them to delight in them.
And so how are you now after all these years of meditation, and how are your relationships, and are you getting the delight you need?
I have wonderful, loving relationships, and I'm actually in secure territory now in terms of that. I would say secure with slightly preoccupied features is where I'm currently at.
So you kind of had to do some re-parenting, self-parenting.
It is a change of view is maybe a better way to put it. You need to see that actually you can get your needs met. And the way to do that is by telling people what your needs are. Surprise.
Right. Yeah.
Right? If you're fearful avoidant, you would never tell somebody what you need because you're afraid that if you tell them, they'll kill you. How often are you going to tell anybody what you need from them if you think that the response is that they'll kill you? Never. You have to be willing to reveal yourself authentically, which is, I like to call it the earthquake and the tsunami. If you're in insecure attachment and you authentically reveal yourself, you're immediately afraid that you'll be abandoned. And if you can hold on to that abandonment tear, regulate that well enough, it will dissolve and you'll be hit by this tsunami of terrible sadness. And then you're just crushed by this terrible sadness. If you can hold on through the terrible abandonment and through the terrible sadness, well, I like to call it the terrible dread and the terrible sadness, then you come into a place of security. We might think that, oh, I'm going to be authentic now and it's going to solve all my problems, but actually you feel much worse doing it in the beginning. And then you have to chip away at all of the conditioning and then gradually be able to reclaim your authenticity. Because if you move toward authenticity and you have this terrible spike of abandonment terror, the inauthentic thing that you could do arises in the mind. And if you choose it, it immediately relieves the abandonment terror. But then in a little while, you're angry that you couldn't be authentic. And then anger is the expression that you make to the person in the relationship. So it is very effortful to reclaim your authenticity. Now, secure people don't understand this and they give no credence for it because they haven't learned how to be inauthentic because they never had a use for it. They've always been authentic. It's always gotten them what they wanted. And so that seems obviously the best way to do it, which is obviously the best way to do it, except that if you grew up in an environment where your authentic expression was in some way punished or the demand was that you be someone else, children will always try their best to become the thing that the parent wants, even if it's a total abandonment of their authenticity because they can't survive without them.
Thank you for helping me understand it. Two last questions. These are quickie. Well, maybe not. We'll see. Is there anything that I should have asked you that I didn't?
I don't know.
Fair enough. For people who want to learn more about you and your group, where could they go?
I have a website called metagroup.org. So they just have to go on there. Pretty much everything is up there.
Thank you very much for doing this. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Nicely done. Okay, that does it for another edition of the 10% Happier podcast. If you liked it, please take a minute to subscribe, rate us. Also, if you want to suggest topics you think we should cover or guests that we should bring in, hit me up on Twitter at Dan B. Harris. Importantly, I want to thank the people who produce this podcast, Lauren Efron, Josh Cohen, and the rest of the folks here at ABC who helped make this thing possible. We have tons of other podcasts. You can check them out at abcnewspodcasts.com. I'll talk to you next Wednesday. If you like 10% Happier, and I hope you do, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
For more than two centuries, the White House has been the stage for some of the most dramatic scenes in American history. Inspired by the hit podcast American History Tellers, Wondery and William Morrow present the new book, The Hidden History of the White House. Each chapter will bring you inside the fierce power struggles, the world-altering decisions, and shocking scandals that have shaped our nation. You'll be there when the very foundations of the White House are laid in 1792, and you'll watch as the British burn it down in 1814. Then you'll hear the intimate conversations between FDR and Winston Churchill as they make plans to defeat Nazi forces in 1941. And you'll be in the Situation Room when President Barack Obama approves the raid to bring down the most infamous terrorist in American history. Pre-order The Hidden History of the White House now in hardcover or digital editions wherever you get your books.
I'm Shimol Yai, and I have a new podcast called The Competition. Every year, 50 high school senior girls compete in a massive scholarship competition.
I wouldn't say I have an ego problem, but I'm extremely competitive.
All of the competitors are used to being the best and the brightest, and they're all vying for a huge cash prize.
This will probably be the most intense thing you've ever gone through in your life.
I remember that feeling because I was one of them. I lost. But now I'm coming back as a judge and also a kind of teen girl anthropologist. Because if you want to understand what it's like to be a young woman in America today, the competition's not a bad place to start.
Hopefully no one will die on stage tonight.
From Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery, this is The Competition. Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.